Hi, it's Dave. Welcome. Today, I'm joined by Emmett Peppers for another episode. We've got a full discussion ahead. We're going to be talking about the latest thoughts, our thoughts on Tesla's price action this past week, Tesla's upcoming Q3 earnings, a possible EV tax credit, and we'll also be diving into Rocket Lab a bit toward the end. Emmett, welcome back on the show. How have you been?
Hey, Dave, I'm doing well. Yeah, good to chat with you again. How's Austin going? Are you back there now pretty longer term again?
Yes, we're back here for the time being. We love it out here. We miss the, oh. There's so much stuff to do in Austin. It's definitely a fantastic city. It's growing.
Yeah, I'm going to come visit when they do the Austin party, Giga Austin party. I'll come visit.
Oh, nice. Yeah, that'd be fun.
Yeah.
We just drove by the factory a couple weeks ago. I showed my kids the factory for the first time, and we flew a drone up, way up there, and my kids were just like having a blast. It's fun stuff.
Does it feel bigger than the Fremont factory? Like, when you drive by the Fremont factory, it's like humongous, right? But when you drive by the Austin one, does it feel bigger?
During construction, it actually felt bigger because it was open, like it had bars and you could see through it, but now it's almost finished. It kind of like you don't get the same feeling as if when it was like during construction. It's kind of weird, but yeah, it's definitely huge. I mean, I think, that thing's going to be pumping out a lot of cars. I think they're sandbagging the actual amount, of cars they could produce. Fun stuff.
Yeah.
I want to start out with your thoughts on recent Tesla price action. So the Friday before, a little over a week ago, Tesla closed at $7.85 on Friday. And then last Friday, two days ago, it closed at $8.43. But then were you watching aftermarket at all on Friday?
Yeah, it was up another like $5 or $6 aftermarket.
Yeah, it was
it was like a little bit of volume. I checked the volume on chart and it was like a few thousand shares here, a few thousand shares there. And for like, right before post-market, like at, 7 o'clock Eastern time, that's a lot of volume for Tesla to trade a few thousand shares, here and there every couple trades.
Did you see any kind of reason or rhyme for kind of this big, jump? I mean, we're talking about almost 65 points in 1 week, right? That's a huge jump.
Yeah. I mean, I think there's a lot of this buy on the rumor, sell on the news going on. I think I put a tweet out there about that, and it just seems like the pattern in the past few quarters when Tesla has had really good, earnings coming up, and we all sort of anticipated it after strong delivery numbers, is that like the week leading up to earnings, the earnings report, the stock really creeps up, and then maybe the day of earnings and the day before earnings, I feel like that's where it sort of gets wiggly and just kind of like state hovers and goes up and down. It's a little volatile. There's a lot of people selling maybe already, and it just sort of stabilizes. So like the buy and the rumor seems to be like it happening like a week before, like maybe this past week, and then maybe even Monday, I don't know, tomorrow. And then it's, if it's a similar pattern to the past, maybe Tuesday and Wednesday, it kind of like dips a tiny bit or stays flat, just stays in a tighter range. And then the earnings come out Wednesday after the close, right? And Wednesday after the earnings come out, and I expect it to blow out, analyst estimates. And I think most people do. And, we're just in like the Tesla Twitterverse, obviously. Mm-hmm. So we have tunnel vision of Tesla bulls. But I think there's a lot more Tesla bulls out there these days than Tesla bears. I think the bears, a lot of them have given up on their short positions and such. And, so I think there's a ton of people expecting Tesla to like blow the earnings out of the water. So when it does, it's hard to know. Like after hours, the stock may even pop like 5%, like it has in the last couple, like last earnings report. But then the next day is when the volume of the institutions kind of hit and during the trading, the business hours of the market. And that's where you kind of see where things really shake out. So, if it keeps up what it did the last couple of quarters that were impressive, I feel like we've seen a big run up already. It might not go up any further next week, even though the earnings will be great, but maybe the weeks after it'll start coming back up and creeping up again, sort of like it did last quarter, right? Last quarter, I think the earnings report was tremendous. After hours, it was up, 5 or 7% or something. The next day, it like came right back down, and at the end of the day, like only up like 1% or something. And but then the weeks following that, it kind of started creeping back up, right? Isn't that what happened last quarter?
Yeah, I think something. Yeah, I mean, every quarter is a blur.
Yeah, for me, it is. Yeah, I mean, these are just things I remember. It's like little roller coaster rides.
It feels so like this past week was different than other pre-earnings run-ups. It just feels like the pace and the strength of this past week was a lot stronger than recent quarters. I don't know.
It was very steady until Friday. On Friday, mm-hmm. it kind of had a really strong close, you know, especially in after, I think the after hours kind of put the exclamation point on it almost, you know?
Yeah. So I think a couple of factors that I was thinking about was, number one, once Tesla kind of broke 800, I knew that everyone would be talking about all-time highs, you know? It's like, I'm always like constantly cognizant of the exact points where I think people are going to be talking about like the exuberance, you know, like, oh, it's going to go higher. And then, because once it goes down to a certain point, then everyone talks about like how far it will go down, you know? Like if Tesla, mm-hmm. once mm-hmm. Tesla goes down to under like 650, then everyone talks about how far can it go down, you know? Above 800, then it's like all-time highs. I think that's part of it. Another part of it I feel like is perhaps institutional investors might be more comfortable with Tesla being like an $800 billion market cap company now. They've had a good kind of better part of the year to digest that. And they've had kind of several quarters in a row of Tesla proving their execution. So I just think there's been like a digestion period, you know, where, you know, when like Tesla at 800, 900 back in January. It was kind of like, it's too high. You know, it's just everyone, like, I don't want to say everyone, but a lot of most
so fast.
People, you just kind of knew it was kind of like high. But I think now, fast forward, you know, 9 months later, this 800 price, it doesn't seem like completely overinflated or overblown, you know? It seems like there's a much more kind of grounded support. And because of that, I feel like, you know, if Tesla can deliver outstanding Q3 earnings, you know, just really ramp their profits and their everything, you know, then I think, who knows? What are your thoughts?
All-time highs,
maybe. Yeah, do you think all-time highs can be broken? All-time high is 900, I think. So what are the chances it's going to be broken?
I mean, I think it's looking, week or two? I mean, we're at 850 almost, right? Yeah. So, I mean, we're getting pretty close to that now. So, I mean, you could see all-time highs in the after hours trading easily on Wednesday when the earnings, you know, hit, as long as the gross margins and everything beats analyst estimates, I think. You could certainly see it. But I mean, it's possible tomorrow, Monday, it breaks up there. It's possible. But I think if we don't like get to 1,000 plus and stick above 1,000 plus, like for more than a few weeks or a week or something straight, if it's just like a short lived spike and it comes right back down to like below 800, you know, maybe even the macro market headwinds hit of some sort and everything comes down, you know, then I worry a little bit, you know, that we're still range bound for some time. But if we can, you know, break out of this kind of range we've been in for 8 or 9 months now of like, I think we've zigzagged between like 500 and 800 several times, even broke 800 one other time, maybe earlier in the year. So if we can kind of break out of this range, which hasn't been that long, 8 or 9 months, you know, I remember the range of like 200 to 300 or whatever. It was like for like 4 or 5 years there, back and forth, you know.
Yeah, 200 to like 380 or so. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So we can break out of that range in 8 or 9 months. That's incredible. I'd be super happy about that. That's like, wow, I guess we're really on a tear here to get to new all-time highs, get to, you know, stay in between a 1 and 2 trillion market cap for a while, I think, you know, and maybe close to 1500 even. I don't know. But I mean, it's fun being an investor in Tesla these days, you know, where, you know, we've been so patient for so long. And now I feel like it's going up much faster than we've expected it, you know, from the past, you know, but hopefully this time that's the case. It's just going to come out of this range pretty quickly here.
Yeah. It's rebounded a lot faster than I thought it would. I thought we were going to be kind of consolidating more, and we still could, who knows,
you
know, but it just seems like if Q3 really, you know, shines and, you know, if we break all time highs, that's pretty fast rebound, I think.
Yeah. One thing I've been thinking that really might be, you know, helping a lot, and this also speaks to like Elon, I think, and his focus on caring for the retail investors. You know, like I think he really cares about the retail investors with the say.com. Like he's really pushed that because he wants retail investors to have a voice. He's, and I think he knows we're such an important part of their success in the past and the stock price going up in the past and stick, you know, and he wants to, you know, help, you know, he sees the value in the retail investors, but I do think with this new, every quarter, a bigger wave of deliveries, you know, what percentage of those deliveries are first time Tesla owners? Probably over half, right? And then what percentage of those people have never bought Tesla stock before? And of those people, what percentage of those people will now buy Tesla stock because they now own a car and they see how amazing it is? And then of those people, what percentage of those people are like really like high net worth people that can put, you know, significant amount of money to work on buying and owning Tesla stock? So I think if you do the math on that over time, that adds a lot of, you know, a lot of extra buying of Tesla shares, kind of like a, you know, a tide rising of more and more high net worth retail folks. And some of these people work in the financial industry and control portfolios of multi-billion dollar funds, maybe even, and they buy Tesla and look at it differently after they experience it and use it. And so I don't know, I think that's a big part of it.
Yeah, I remember you've mentioned kind of this point many times over the years, how there's this like kind of this continuous cycle of new Tesla owners who can be new Tesla investors. And I'm also thinking like, out of the institutional investors, like pretty much almost every one of them probably has had the chance to either test drive or buy, you know, a Tesla themselves, especially with the Model 3, it's like all over the place. So even if they're in, you know, the East Coast, it's still like the exposure is just so different than it was just 5 years ago. Even on YouTube, absolutely. Like, you know, I might watch like a video on Tesla or Tesla stock, and the chances are this person who's, you know, sharing this video, even though I don't know them, perhaps it's the first video I've seen of them, they own a Tesla, you know? And it's like the reach is just growing. So now it's like, and then you have to also think about what other choices do people have in terms of investing in growth, you know? And you could, yeah, sure, you could do kind of the stable, like the Apple and Google, Facebook and Microsoft, whatever. Or you could do a bit more of these like kind of software or B2B plays. You can go to Netflix or something, but it just seems Tesla has some mind share, you know, has some appeal as kind of like something that, you know, I wouldn't say it's guaranteed, but has a high likelihood of success in 10 years, you know, to be a much bigger company than it is now. So it seems to be carving out its place, you know, in the market. Definitely interesting.
Yeah, I mean, I view Tesla, I was talking to some friends the other day, and I view Tesla as like the safest bet to get like a 5x return over the next 5 to 10 years. But there's probably a lot of other companies that'll do much better. I just don't know who those are, you know, smaller cap companies that'll have a 10x or 50x return in 10 years, but I just don't know who those are. But Tesla to me is like the safest to get, you know, a significant return over the next 5 to 10 years, I'd say.
Yeah. What do you think about earnings? So earnings, we have Q3 earnings on Wednesday, October 20th. It seems like this would be the first earnings that Elon probably doesn't attend the shareholder or the conference call. Like, I don't remember if he's ever not attended a conference call, actually.
I don't think so. Remember he used to lead those conference calls even in between quarterly earnings? He'd have like a conference call with like all the press and invite them on like some new feature Tesla's releasing, and there'd be a Q&A and we could all dial in and listen to it. So he used to do a lot of this stuff, and now he's phasing them out, and now he's not even going to do the earnings calls. And that's a good thing for him. You know, he needs to spend less time on that, more time on, you know, everything else. But I don't think he's ever missed one for being sick or anything.
I was thinking like there are definitely pros and cons, you know. I think Elon on the conference call, it shows how like much he's in control of things. Like if he just makes a decision on the spot and it's his decision.
Oh, I guess we'll get rid of the NDAs. Yeah. Remember on the Kara Swisher, you know, we don't need those NDAs. And his lawyers are probably like, what are you doing, Elon, in the back room?
but
whatever he says goes.
Yeah. What's interesting though, is with other people, let's say it's now Zach Kierkorn or Drew Baglino and some others, like it's going to be interesting because I think naturally there's going to be some level of them taking a little bit more ownership and stepping up, because they're having to answer these questions from the biggest investors out there. And so,
they won't be able to put the call on mute to like quickly check with Elon before they answer it, like in the past they used to do.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So I think it actually could signify Elon actually delegating a bit more, you know, of the company's kind of leadership in some different aspects. You know, obviously he's still in control. He's making the top decisions, but I wonder if, and then with, I think this coincides also with his attention being kind of drawn to SpaceX right now and Starship.
Yeah.
Where he's just seeing like, hey, there's so much work to be done. Tesla seems to be like in a, on a good path, you know, like they've got good teams, they got good products. And, but yeah, I think it's, I wouldn't go so far to say it's a turning point, but it definitely is a marker where, you know, Elon stepping out of conference calls, I think, is signifying hopefully a step up from other of his team members. Is there anything on Q3 earnings that you're expecting? You mentioned you expect a big beat, but in what way?
Yeah, I mean, I think the gross margins are going to be significant. I think I've seen estimates of, you know, 25% or higher. You know, if it's higher than 25%, that would beat my, that's about my kind of over under. But I think they'll show their operating leverage here. I know you've talked about it many times, you know, as they produce more cars, each car is incrementally less cost for them to produce and deliver. And so it'll show in their gross margins per car sold. And there's a higher variance of performance Model 3 sold and such because people wanted to get their cars sooner and those are being shipped and prioritized more. So there's a lot of things, I think, in their favor for this quarter. And we'll have to see. So Dave, what do you think about Q3 earnings? Like what are you most excited about? Do you see any upside surprise? Do you think, you know, there's anything people aren't really expecting that could happen to, you know, provide more upside than people are sort of suspecting here?
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of the quarterly earnings are actually already revealed when the delivery numbers get revealed, you know, at the end of the quarter. So as long as like the deliveries are high, then it just improves all of Tesla's numbers immensely because of, you know, it's like with each additional car sold, they're just gaining extra profit because their operating expenses are just set for that quarter. So if you just send, if you, you know, produce 50 times or 50% more, then you're going to get like a ton more profit because your operating expenses are still, you know, the same. And so, I think it's this interesting thing where I don't think people yet completely understand it because they don't work out the numbers, but every quarter from now on, it feels like as long as Tesla increases the numbers, they're going to have like really, really great, you know, quarters. You're going to see like profit after profit. I'm looking at EBITDA especially, wanting to see how high that goes, but last quarter was their adjusted EBITDA was about $2.4 billion. So, you know, we'll see like how far it goes, if it can go up, you know, past $3.5 billion or so.
Wow.
And at an annual run rate, it could be close to $15 billion. And if you do a 60 multiple off of, you know, a $15 billion annual run rate, that's about $900 billion market cap. And so that seems pretty, you know, seems a pretty fair market cap valuation there. But yeah, it's, I'm excited just because like, it just, there's so much, I guess, that is lining up for Tesla in terms of like compared to a few years ago where they're just like struggling. Now it's just like everything seems to be, you know, falling into place. On a side note, so I was just texting this one guy. So I'm shopping for a car for my parents. The problem is like with a Tesla, it's like, my mom has like arthritis, she's getting old and she can't use the Model 3 or Model Y door handles. And so she's like, okay. And so we're looking at different cars, but then like I was talking to a Honda dealer right now and he's saying like that this month and last month has been absolutely crazy for car prices. And he says like 5 months ago, it was a completely different situation. And you can get cars under MSRP, but he's saying like all his Honda Accords or whatever, they're just all over MSRP and the prices have just shot up off the roof. It's just crazy right now, he's saying. And so,
wow,
yeah, there's something going on. I think all of that, just at least temporarily, it helps Tesla because they could basically charge whatever they want, because the whole industry is going through this like kind of crunch, you know. There's not enough cars, I think, for the demand out there. So yeah, I think it's definitely going to be interesting.
Absolutely. Yeah, I saw your, I listened to your chat with Brad Ferguson as well about the option stuff. What, I mean,
yeah, I was going to ask you about that one.
Interesting take. Yeah. I mean, I thought what's funny about this is, you know, I don't know if it's ironic or what, but, you know, after the comments from Lorena Gonzalez and stuff, but this is going to be, I think, like the largest individual tax, you know, bill paid to the state of California in the history, you know, of California. So they just kicked out the one person who's giving them the largest tax bill they've ever gotten, you know, and maybe they're not going to get that type of tax bill ever again from him, you know, because I think he earned most of it while he was working in California, just to pay the California tax on it.
Yeah.
I think that's what, you know, people, you know, CPAs are suggesting, what Brad mentioned. So it's going to be insane that, you know, this, he's going to pay probably, I guess if his tax bill is what, $9 or $10 billion, is that what it is approximately for this?
Yeah,
right.
It's like $10 billion probably.
Yeah. I think like, $3 billion of that maybe is like California, state of California, right? 16% of the 53 or whatever. So like 1/3 of it or something will be California. So like $3 billion of that goes to the state of California or something. So for an individual to pay that kind of tax bill to a state just seems kind of incredible. Like, man, that's a huge windfall for California that they're getting here. But this might be the last big tax bill that they actually ever get from Elon, but it's like a going away present from Elon or something. I don't know.
Yeah. For those who don't know, so the conversation I had with Bradford Ferguson this past week was, so I saw your tweet about kind of the options, and then I was doing some research, and then I DM'd him and he was willing to do a Skype call. He was just going to do a personal Skype call, but then I ended up saying, hey, let's record it, you know, and then, you know, other people can benefit. But it turns out Elon has about 22 million shares of basically options that he needs to exercise by August 2022. But it appears he's going to start exercising some of them in Q4, actually around now, according to this Recode conference that he talked at with Kara Swisher. So the issue is he has 22 million to exercise, but then he has to keep... he has to sell 12 million to pay taxes, and he'll keep 10 million shares. But my question to you is, 12 million shares are going to be somehow, you know, put on the market. It is in effect a cap raise in a sense, at least in terms of the share issuance. So you have 12 million shares.
Before you go into, I mean, this, I think that's one like assumption based on what he's maybe we're inferring from how he explained it to Kara Swisher. But I would also say there's a possibility that he doesn't sell the shares, that he does work out a borrowing, you know, a term loan. I mean, he's got the top investment bankers and top wealth managers in the world, from Goldman Sachs and Morgan Stanley, working with him, competing, doing over anything they can. The top ones in the world doing anything they can to get his business. And they're going to come up with any kind of creative solution they can, some kind of like crazy term loan or whatever. And when you think about it, I think his net worth is like $220 billion, I saw over the weekend after this recent rise.
Yeah.
So like borrowing $9 billion against $220 billion. I mean, that's just like, I have a stronger ratio of margin loan on my account. You know, $9 billion sounds like a lot, but when your net worth is $220 billion and you have the top investment bankers and wealth managers in the world at the top institutions trying to come up with creative solutions for you, I'm not so sure he's definitely going to sell shares to pay the taxes. He may very well do that, but I wouldn't be surprised if he doesn't sell any shares. And I wouldn't be surprised if he sells some proportion of shares and borrows more at the same time, maybe does some combination. But anyway, go on with what you're saying.
Yeah. I mean, I think it could be also, shares. Yeah. I think it also could be spaced out, right? Let's say some this quarter, next quarter or whatever. So maybe in 3 or 4 installments. So maybe it doesn't flood the market right away. You know, and I don't know, my thinking is like 90% chance he sells for the taxes, just because it just adds so much complexity to have to go through these elaborate, you know, borrow schemes. It just seems like it isn't worth it where he's at right now.
I would say you're at 90%. I would say like 50-50, to be honest.
Really? Wow.
I'm 50-50. Yeah.
Yeah.
It seems like, I think it's very up in the air.
It seems like his mind is ready made up, though, to pay the taxes and to, you know, I don't know. That's the feeling I got.
I mean, he'll pay the taxes, but he might borrow to pay the taxes. You know, just like I borrow against my account, you know, I don't sell all my Tesla shares to pay my taxes, you know. It's like painful, you know, you own a good amount of Tesla and you know it's going to be the biggest company in the world. And he said many times, several times that Tesla is going to be the biggest company in the world. So if he really believes that, you know, he might want to hold on to those shares. And if he can get an attractive deal from these investment bankers. And if he does sell the shares, you know, he might just very well do that to keep it simple, you know, like you said, and not have to worry about it at all. But I wouldn't be surprised if he doesn't. I mean, he's still paying the taxes. It's just whether he's selling the shares to pay the taxes or borrowing against his net worth to pay the taxes, you know?
Yeah. Are you concerned, like, at all with the stock price, with, let's say, if he does sell all these shares?
No, because I've done the math. And, you know, even if Tesla and SpaceX dropped 75% in value, you know, I'm assuming his net worth drops from $220 billion to, like, you know, $55 billion net worth. Well, he can still have like a $10 billion. I mean, his current margin loan collateral, people estimate to be a few hundred million he's borrowed against his shares up to date. So his borrowing might be $10 billion out of net worth of 55. You know, that's still enough to support that. Yeah. But it's a little obviously more nerve wracking.
I guess what I mean is, are you concerned if let's say he does sell 12 million shares, are you concerned that will impact the stock price at all, like negatively?
I'm not so sure, because I think, you know, these investment banks, I don't think he's going to go, I don't think they're going to like sell the shares out in the open market. You know, I think there's all kinds of ways these top tier investment banks can handle blocks of millions of shares. You know, they might already have institutional clients lined up waiting to get big chunks of shares of Tesla without having to trading into them, you know, without having to, you know, buy into it and move the market when they're buying a couple million shares, you know. So I'm not so worried about it. Maybe some of these investment banks want to hold some shares themselves to help, you know, make a market on Tesla and stabilize the price or whatnot. You know, there's lots of things they do, they can do, I think, with an allotment of, you know, 10 million shares or however many it would be, I guess, 12 million shares. So I'm not so concerned. I know some people are, but I think there'll be a couple of news headlines about it perhaps, but that's as bad as it, you know, I don't think it's going to like dramatically move the stock price. Like when we find out there's a cap raise of X million shares in the past, you know, suddenly the stock would be down 10% over after hours or 5% or whatever.
Yeah, I tend to kind of lean on your side where it doesn't seem like it would be the biggest deal because there could be preparation ahead of time. Yeah. It's not something like, you know, all at once. There's a lot of big banks involved as well. Elon probably doesn't have to get the best price. He could, I mean, there's some, you know, probably room to maneuver. And then also compared to the S&P 500, you had, you know, S&P 500, you had like 120 million shares, right? That these passive index funds had to get plus, you know, these benchmarked funds. So it could have been like, you know, 150, 200 million shares. So it's a completely different ball game, you know, when you're talking about, you know, 12 versus like, you know, 150 or 200 million. Interesting stuff.
Yeah. There's a lot of, like you said, there's a lot of preparation time in this. It's not going to be a very sudden event. You know, they're already probably putting plans in place, presenting Elon with all kinds of options. And maybe it's already been picked the option he wants to use. And maybe, like you said, there's preparations. They're lining up some institutional clients. Maybe his tweet to Warren Buffett, like, you should invest in Tesla, was like a draw, like, hey, I got a few million shares. I can give you a market price. I don't know. You don't have to worry about trading into it. Berkshire could just have these at $850 or whatever, you know, who knows? So, you know, there's probably some institutional investors that missed the boat and would love to just get a couple million shares without having to trade into it and move the stock. Because today, if you're trying to buy, if you're trying to net buy a million shares on the open market on a given day, it could move the stock on one given day, you know, 20 or 30 or 40 bucks. And you're like, oh, I didn't get the best average price. But if you got a block trade of it at $850 even, you'd rather do that.
Yeah, that makes sense. Yeah. And there are definitely people out there who, you know, who do a million, 2 million shares and stuff, or groups, holders. Next week, I'm interviewing Professor Leo Koguan, supposedly the third largest individual retail shareholder. So I actually was able to confirm his holdings. He actually like emailed me his like brokerage kind of confirmation letters of how many shares he has. And I also heard directly from Tesla IR that they've confirmed, yeah, like directly from, you yeah know, to me that.
And Martin, he did yeah it on Twitter too, I yeah think, Martin Viecka, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So I'm curious, what are some like things that you would want to ask, you know, of him? What are kind yeah of like the key kind of ideas or thoughts, you know, you have?
Yeah, I mean, he's just a fascinating guy. I mean, he's got, you know, a different perspective on the world and reality, you know, the reality we all live in. He sees it, you know, in a unique way, and he's a very special, super smart guy, you know, and I'd pick his brain on that stuff, try to understand kind of, you know, what this, I think KQID time engine represents, if I could wrap my head around what he's saying and on that, obviously. And just try to understand, I guess, his framework for coming to this decision to really go even more all in on Tesla more recently. You know, what was his framework originally? I guess he's been a long-term shareholder for a long time, right? So how did he discover, like, his kind of history of coming to figure out Tesla, you know, and
yeah
and how, you know, what he sees in the future of Tesla, like this, how soon does he think it could be the biggest company in the world, you know, and you know, that kind of stuff. Just his viewpoint is definitely unique and interesting in a lot of ways. And, you know, a lot of the same stuff we ask a lot of early investors to find out from his view, maybe. That's, I guess, my curiosity where it would lead me.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. Yeah, those are great questions. I'll definitely ask some of them. Yeah, what's interesting to me about his situation is he's this billionaire, yet he's in control of his own research and decisions with investing. A lot of billionaires, like, these hand it off, you know, to their family office or to investment banks or whatever, you know, like, they're not really yeah in touch. And then he's not just doing it himself. He's actually doing these super concentrated bets, you know, like to hold whatever 5+ million, you know, shares of Tesla. It's very, very, like, it's abnormal in a sense for a billionaire to go all in, you know, on one thing. Usually you would be very diversified, you know, do a 5% position here or whatever. But he almost feels like just like a guy who hasn't like gone over to the, I won't say institutional side, but hasn't like followed the typical path of a person who's, you know, like reached that type of wealth and has kind of, he's held on to his kind of, his individual decision-making and his kind of intuition and, you know, the way that he's always made decisions in the past. So I'm curious. All right. So, I want to talk about Rocket Lab. So at the end of our last chat, you mentioned there was this company that, you know, you're invested in, but you have to tell later. You just told me to say about this company, Rocket Lab. Actually, last night I asked you about it. And you're saying that this has become kind of one of your larger positions or close to largest, I guess, in your fund. I'm curious, like, where did this all come from and what kind of inspired you guys to make kind of a decision to go big on Rocket Lab?
Yeah, when I think, you know, space is a big industry of the future, and I believe it'll be a $1 trillion revenue business by the end of the decade. Now, you know, I think you and I and almost everyone watching this probably agrees that SpaceX is the leader, you know, by far. And I think that too. I think that they will remain the leader by far, right? So this is an interesting play. This is like betting on second place, you know, like, I'm not betting on the leader like I am with Tesla. Like, I think Tesla's the leader in EVs and will be the biggest car company and the biggest company in the world. You know, it's like betting on the leader to win it all. You know, this is more of a value play because Rocket Lab, you know, SpaceX, you know, it's trading on, you know, the secondary, you know, private markets, it's trading at close to $100 billion valuation and these special purpose vehicles with like crazy fees embedded in them and such. If it was traded publicly, it would probably trade well above $100 billion market cap, in my view, you know. And publicly, there are a bunch of publicly traded, you know, startup space companies. I think Rocket Lab is the number two company for lower Earth orbit capabilities. It's the only other company that I know of that sent you know, a bunch of satellites and had a bunch of launches. I think they've had 21 launches or something over that, successful launches now to lower Earth orbit. You know, we watch things on Blue Origin or Virgin Galactic. Those guys aren't going to lower Earth orbit. That's a whole different ballgame when you go to lower Earth orbit. That's like another 100 miles up, you know, you got to go or something. It's a, you know, I think Elon's even commented on it, that it's a much different ballgame going to lower Earth. Or he said, like, hey, Blue Origin, Jeff, you should try going to lower Earth. Or, you know, he's teased him about it because he knows it's much harder. You know, mm-hmm. It's like building an EV concept car versus mass producing it, you know? And so Rocket Lab is successfully sending rockets up to lower Earth orbit for a couple of years now, and reusable rocket, they're going the reusable rocket path. And so I think they'll be, maybe even if they're a distant second place to SpaceX, but I think they'll be second place for the rest of the decade. And right now they're a $6 billion market cap valuation. You know, that's their value after their SPAC merger and such. So, I mean, that seems like an incredible steal to me. And we've been looking at it for a while. We've been listening to Peter Beck. He's the founder and CEO. And the more I listen to him speak and hear his story, the more impressed I am as a founder. Like, he's kind of one of these special guys, in my opinion. Like, you know, he's not Elon, of course, but he's one of these, like, maybe he's a generational founder of a company, you know, and he knows what he's doing. They have launch pad facilities in New Zealand that have really worked out. Like, there's a lot of good things I see in Rocket Lab. You know, it's risky. I don't know enough about the business model to know they're not going to run out of money before they get enough launches. It's a risky thing. It's not a given thing that they're going to be that they're going to succeed long term, obviously, right? So, But I think the risk reward to me is well worth, you know, the bet in investing in them. Yeah. And so we bought a bunch of the Rocket Lab when it was before the SPAC merger in July and August, and a bunch of the warrants. And, you know, it's done well. Went up to from 10 to 20 bucks briefly. And we were like, whoa, that's awesome. You know, and it came back down to like $12 or $13 now. Yeah. We put out a research report last week on it to kind of come public about it officially.
Mm. What percent of your fund is Rocket Lab, like, holding wise?
Probably a number two or number three. It's about, mm-hmm. I'd say it's tied with like Roblox. I mean, Tesla's number one, mm-hmm. And then Rocket Lab and Roblox are kind of like around tied for number two. You know, Rocket Lab was pretty high. When it went up to $20, it was pretty high. It was maybe our, you know, could have been our largest holding for a short while there when mm-hmm. it was up to 20 bucks because we didn't sell any and all the warrants went up and, you know. But that's why I've said, like, I think I wouldn't be surprised if we don't plan to sell anytime soon. We think this takes, you know, 6 months or a year until the market comes to consensus that, hey, Rocket Lab is legitimate and it's the way to invest in a publicly traded company to get into space. You know, we think that it's just a matter of time before markets realize, you know, that everyone involved in the public markets who want to get exposure to space realize Rocket Lab is the most legitimate player out there that you can actually publicly invest in, you know, because you can't publicly invest in SpaceX, you know. So I think once that consensus comes, that's, you know, then it'll be worth a lot more than it is now. And we're hoping the next 6 to 12 months, kind of as more of their launches materialize, they sign more deals and such. That's another thing. I think the deals, you know, like, we think analysts have read reports on Rocket Lab and we do our own analysis. But the biggest stakeholders on whether Rocket Lab, you know, fails or succeeds, in my opinion, is the deals that the people on the other end of the deals that they sign up with. So recently SpaceX and NASA awarded Rocket Lab some deals, as well as a Japanese company, I think, Estrada or something like that, signed a deal in September with Rocket Lab to send some stuff to lower Earth orbit. So they're signing up new businesses, new rocket launch partners for more launches and satellites and such. So the fact that they're signing up these kind of making these deals to me speaks strongly as like a strong signal that these guys are legit.
So my kind of, questions with Rocket Lab, and obviously haven't done much research on them, but is when I look at some of their financials, they're still going to be like pretty cash flow negative for quite a while. You know, it's probably not going to be until 2024, if not, I don't know, later. And it seems like, you know, they're going to be very dependent on the capital markets to continue, you know, to fund their business. And so it feels like it's going to be a volatile stock, you know? And then a lot of it is going to be kind of like, I don't know, I prefer to I prefer them to be closer to, you know, that tipping point of like going cash flow positive, like EBITDA positive or something, you know, where it's like there's self-sustaining or whatever, this big move where you can't catch this company anytime again, like, you know,
that's the risk.
It's going to be a real rocket, you know, like ship, just like going whatever. But as long as they're like cash flow negative and they have to go to the markets again, it just seems that there's a few factors. One is they're going to be susceptible to short attacks, to FUD media, to, you know, like bigger moves in the market. And like this consensus, you know, 6 to 12 months thing where you're like, hey, we think that people realize that these guys are the real thing. That definitely seems like a legitimate possibility. And like, I'd definitely be interested in finding out more. I mean, I guess I'm curious about how sharp the CEO really is. And so, yeah, I need to dive into these interviews. How many interviews have you watched of Peter Beck?
I think like 6 or 7 now.
Okay.
I mean, there's not as many out there. And from recent, I try to listen to the interviews from the last like 2 or 3 years. And as opposed to, I should go further back probably, but everything I've listened to, you know, he's a pretty humble guy. You know, I think what he did to have the capability to launch rockets from New Zealand, where they are now, as a U.S. company, is pretty incredible. Like how he was able to lobby Congress to get that that permission, almost. You know, in a way, that's a sort of a unique advantage. If there is any advantage they have to SpaceX, it's that they have, I think, more flexibility with their launch cadence, being New Zealand versus where SpaceX has to launch from in Texas, for example. So, you know, their specialty is sort of right now is the smaller satellite launches to lower Earth orbit. And they're somewhat competitive with SpaceX. I mean, people are like, oh, SpaceX is going to eat their lunch and whatnot. But I think Rocket Lab, for a certain a niche right now, is somewhat competitive with SpaceX. It's probably not as cost effective for launch, you know, for the businesses or governments that want to necessarily use them. But no one wants to just rely on one company, I think. I think especially the governments, they want to spread it out. Like you saw NASA and Space Force just spread out thing. They just did a couple of deals and spread it out to, I think, a combination of SpaceX, Rocket Lab, and United Launch Alliance or something, ULA. And ULA certainly has the lobbying dollars to like get that, right? I don't think Rocket Lab has some crazy lobbying effort to get that, right? Why are they getting it, right? You got to think about it. Why is Rocket Lab in this mix with SpaceX and United Launch Alliance, right? There's something there, you know, like you got to, I feel like I'm trying to read between the lines here.
Yeah.
And I think that there's a high chance that it, like in my mind, it's like, even if it's 50-50, right? I think it's higher. I think it's probably like 70% chance that Rocket Lab is a legitimate number two player. They might lose money for a few years, but even if they lose money for a few years, just being seen as a legitimate number two player, I think awards them a higher valuation than they have now.
Yeah.
You know, when people look at SpaceX and they want to get more exposure to space and their space ETF or just in their portfolio, I want to buy some space stuff. Instead of 3D printing companies, they can actually buy a company that's actually the second place to SpaceX, you know? And SpaceX, I don't think they aren't making money. They're losing money too. You know, I mean, Starlink is the hope that they'll, you know, me and you can see that more clearly. They're losing money too. I mean, what year are they going to start making money? Right. So it's a risk, right? But I think from the 6 billion market cap valuation they have now, it seems a risk well worth taking in my mind.
Yeah.
Sort of like the S&P. I feel like I'd be silly not to take that risk in my mind. So sort of like S&P inclusion bet, where I felt like that's a big risk to bet on this S&P inclusion option trade, but I just think the probability is too high not to do it, you know?
So SpaceX has, you know, Starlink, and then Starlink is like the hope for SpaceX to go profitable, but very soon. I mean, if, you know, they can get this, which is, they're doing amazing things right now. It's just, you know, 100.
How soon would you say, like 2 years, 3 years, 4 years, profitable?
Yeah. I think 2 years max. Okay. Yeah. And, but it's not just it's profitable, but it's going to be extremely, extremely profitable. I think that's like a big reason, like, you know, SpaceX gets the 100 billion plus, you know, market cap valuation. For Rocket Labs, like, what is their Starlink? Like, what is that thing that's going to give them profit and turn their whole ship around where they're just a lucrative cash, you know, making machine?
I don't think the path is there to be a lucrative cash making machine. That's too early. I mean, but before Starlink came to like a big deal, Like, let's say Starlink was out of the equation. What would SpaceX's valuation be?
I mean, probably 50 billion max.
You think Starlink is half more than valuation half. Right now?
Yeah, more than half. Okay. Yeah. I mean, maybe. Yeah. That's fair. I mean, it's the other thing is, like, you know, SpaceX has been working on Starlink for quite a while, you know, like probably 5 years or so. So it's not a new project. And this stuff takes a while to get, you know, if it's been 5 years and then it's another 2 years, it takes 7 years, right, to turn this thing around for SpaceX.
Yeah.
My question with Rocket Lab is, what is their cash cow? Is it, if it's the launch business, I'm like, oh my gosh, give me a break. You're dealing with like every single, like, I want to say every single billionaire out there, but you have Elon Musk and then you have their next generation Neutron, right? Their bigger rocket, which will be like the size of the Falcon 9, but you're going to be competing against the Falcon 9, you know? I mean, I don't know. It's true.
But I'm saying, like, without Starlink, you're saying SpaceX is 50 billion. Okay, well, the second place is only 6 billion. I think that's a pretty, I think the second place should be like 10 or 20 billion.
Well,
you know, SpaceX, without Starlink. But I'm also saying, like, you know, in the future, there's going to be much more opportunities. And you're saying every billionaire, but none of the billionaires can get to lower Earth orbit. You know, they're all trying. They all get to, like, you know, whatever that line is, that there's weightlessness, but they can't go beyond that, you know. And Rocket Lab's been doing it for years already now. And they're building a new rocket to do it, too.
Well,
and I just think government contracts, mining on asteroids, you know, there's going to be factories in space.
Yeah, I mean, I agree on the long term. The long term, there's going to be huge opportunities. But I'm talking about the next 5 or 10 years. It's like, you know, the rocket launch business, SpaceX has shown, is just so limited. Mm-hmm. You know, you're not going to make billions off of that of profit, obviously. And then, you know, like, I know Rocket Labs makes satellites as well and does other stuff, but is that really going to be their cash cow? It's like, what SpaceX has done is not just create satellites, but they're creating a whole internet constellation to basically take half the world's internet traffic through their, you know, satellites. You know, that's incredible, right? But I'm saying, where is the ambition of Peter Beck and Rocket Lab to do something that's super incredible that will radically turn around Rocket Lab into this cash cow of a business within, let's say, 5 to 7 years? Do they have something like that?
Well, what I'm going to come back to you with is, with the type of argument I think that you put forward, which is, you know, a legitimate argument, then you could say there's no other space company out there that should be worth more than $5 billion. You know, SpaceX is just going to eat everything, you know? That's the type of argument you're putting out there. And that's an argument people could make. You know, I don't agree with that argument. I think there is going to be another space company that's evolving, that's going to be legitimate, that's going to be worth more than $5 billion. And I think that's Rocket Lab.
You know? I mean,
and I'm not an astrophysicist myself. I'm not an astronaut. Yeah. I've read a bunch of reports. I can talk about the businesses that they're going into, but I'm not kind of like going to be able to talk about the physics of how their rockets work versus the physics of SpaceX's rockets, you know?
Yeah. I mean, okay. So first thing is, I want to see, like, SpaceX engineers and leadership compliment Rocket Lab and saying Rocket Lab is definitely our second, you know, like, place, like,
well, you know, closest competitor. Elon did sort of give them, in my view, I think Elon did sort of give them a passive acknowledgement just like a week ago, right? On Twitter. I mean, and he has commented, I think, when they did launch something to low Earth orbit, like 2 years ago, the first time, I think, if I recall, back, I didn't really know Rocket Lab back then, but I remember Elon commenting on another company sending something to low Earth orbit, like, congratulations, that's a big step. And I was like, who is this other company? It's only SpaceX in my mind. I didn't know anything about Rocket Lab. And then over time, the last, like, 6 months or so, last 9 months, I think I started learning about Rocket Lab when they announced their SPAC plans in January. I had a few people kind of message me about it and bring it to my attention. And so I was like, I don't know what this Rocket Lab, I mean, there's all these companies, people are like, oh, Peter Beck, you got to study him. And so I was, you know, started studying him on my own and learning about it. And over the last several months, it's really become a more of a conviction to me that, like, hey, whoever the second place is going to be, I think it'll be Rocket Lab. Like, and the second place to SpaceX, I think, should be worth more than $5 or $10 billion, you know? And so that's kind of, in a nutshell, from a bird's eye view, my thesis. I mean, we've gone into more details looking at different reports from Cowen and other research firms that have put out extensive reports, you know, 20, 30 page reports on SpaceX. I can't rehash everything they say word for word right now, but it seems to make sense. They all have legitimate cases for why SpaceX should be worth, you know, $20 or $30 a share right now. But my biggest case is just like, hey, who's second place to SpaceX? To me, it seems more obvious and obvious over time that Rocket Lab's second place. And if there is, you know, whatever the second place should be, I think it's going to be worth more than $5 or $10 billion as a market cap, as a value. You know, it might not be able to be justified with EBITDA in the next couple of years, but I think the market will put a value on it that's above $5 or $10 billion when SpaceX is at, you know, trading. Starlink and SpaceX are at $100 to $200 billion market cap.
So, I mean, I completely understand, I think, your angle, which I agree to a lot of it, but I guess where I kind of am adding or give my angle a little bit that differs is like, yeah, I mean, sure, they could be worth more than 5 or 10 billion, maybe 10 or 20 or maybe 30 billion in the next, you know, 5 years or something. I don't know.
That'd be incredible.
Who knows?
Yeah. Then you have 5X, 6X return.
But
like,
it seems like my I want a higher margin of safety. Like, I want something that's like, hey, these guys are shooting for something that's like, I want to say a guarantee. Yeah. Okay. These guys are shooting for something in the next 5 years that if they achieve it will be a guaranteed 10X. Like, that's kind of the thing I want for a company like in this field, especially if you're going against like SpaceX and Elon Musk, you know?
Yeah.
Like,
I mean, I would say if Rocket Lab, I mean, they put out their own projections for the next few years, and I forget the exact number at the moment, but we can go on their website and look at their kind of reports they put out. But they think they'll have a certain amount of cash flow in 2 or 3 years from now. I think it's like $500 million or $1 billion of cash flow, you know, or in a few years. So, I mean, you can kind of come up with multiples where they're maybe, you know, 20 times revenue easily in a couple of years, and maybe 30 times revenue or 40 times revenue if they're growing fast in a space industry. And you know, you can come up with multiples where they're easily in 5 years worth $50 billion, you know, if they really succeed the way they think they will, you know. And $50 billion from 6 billion, that's 10x and almost, that's 9x, 8x or whatever in five years. I think yes, that's completely possible for them. I mean, I don't know if it's probable, but I think it's as high as a probability as Tesla 10Xing in 5 years, to be honest.
Yeah.
10X.
I just want to be convicted or have assurance of their superior product. Like, in what way, right, is their product like far superior than anything else on the market?
This is different. It's betting on second place. Yeah. This is betting on second place. It's a very different mindset for this. It's not betting on the best of anything. You know, this is betting on, but there's going to be more than one service provider for space, and
but
they're going
to even with the second place, they need to be best at something.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know.
Well, I think they're going to have more.
I think
they're going to have flexible. I think there's going to be enough demand, not just for SpaceX. Will have other priorities too. They're going to be focused on Starship. They're going to be certain businesses that maybe they won't want to take that will go right to Rocket Lab, and SpaceX might prioritize one thing, and that customer will say, no, we need it this month. We'll use Rocket Lab, or maybe certain governments just don't want to use SpaceX, but it's a U.S. Rocket Lab's in the U.S., but it's technically physically located in New Zealand. You know, there's advantages of being launched from New Zealand maybe versus Texas. So there's different niche reasons why I think companies are going to be using Rocket Lab. I mean, they're signing up partners. I mean, I think there's like 3 new deals they signed in the last month. I mean,
yeah, I mean, they do have an impressive backlog. I know they have a ton of,
And that's what my other point is, like, you got to try, like, I can do as much due diligence, you can do as much due diligence as, like, you know, armchair couch investors on space when we're not astrophysicists ourselves, we're not building rockets ourselves with our own hands. But the actual, you know, people that are trying to send their satellites to space, whether it's commercial companies or governments, they're the ones that I think are the most experts on who they should be using, right? And there's a reason they're choosing Rocket Lab, in my mind. What's the reason, right? There's no lobbyists really for Rocket Lab in these governments like there is for ULA, you know?
Yeah.
They're not the number one company that we all think SpaceX is, but yet Rocket Lab is getting a piece of the pie on a lot of these contracts. I mean, there's that to me speaks volumes that I, you know, to me, it's a big signal.
Yeah, definitely. I think that's a huge, huge signal. I definitely agree.
Yeah. I mean, it's just
intriguing company, definitely.
Intriguing. I challenge you, Dave, to listen to some of Peter Beck's interviews.
Yes.
And then tell me back, report back to what you think. Yeah,
yes. I'm next next chat, we'll talk about Peter Beck.
Yeah, but you have good insights on these.
Yeah, if anyone has connections to Peter Beck, please let me know. I want to interview him too. Love to do a deep dive into his mind and how he approaches things.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Emmett, thanks for chatting. We'd love to hear your thoughts after Q3 earnings and, you know, after the next week or two. But yeah, always fun hanging out, and definitely wish you the best, and we'll chat again.
Yeah, good luck with your interview with Leo, and looking forward to listening to that later. And looking forward to chat with you again soon.
Awesome. Okay, take care.
Okay, thanks.